This conference will now be recorded.
Right, hello everybody, and welcome to this special PBIC teleclass with a very good friend of mine, a very special guest who I know a bit about, but I'm looking forward to this call because I want to find out more about her, her business, and we're specifically going to be talking about franchising because this is something that I know that the guest has tinkered around with and is looking at to incorporate into her business. But anyway, enough of all that. Why don't I just introduce Teresa Payne? Hello, Teresa.
Hello, Dom. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Are you well?
Yeah, it's great to be here. I've been really looking forward to catching up with you. It's been too long.
No, it really has. Yeah, yeah. So we're both going to catch up. Super duper. So why don't you? This is going to be really interesting, Teresa, because I want to find out more about your story, which I don't know a lot about. I mean, I know you and I know Ash and but that, like, and I know you're a lawyer and you've got a business, but that's like about it. You know what I mean? I don't know a lot else. So let us go right back to as far as you can remember what life was like growing up, how, you know, what jobs you had and how you stumbled into business.
Yeah, I have to think back. You know, it's funny, isn't it? It's, I suppose, as you said, I'm a lawyer and I live in the southeast of England now, but I didn't start living in this area. I actually grew up in the South Wales Valley, in the Rhondda Valleys, which is a coal mining area, so very working class background. Mm-hmm. And did the usual thing, went to the local comprehensive school, and I actually left school at 16. I actually left a bit before I was 16 because I didn't bother to turn up. So for those reasons, I left without any qualifications. And I said my first job was on a market stall in a market in Pontypridd. And we were selling, back in those days, sort of ladies' fashions, you know, dresses, mm-hmm. jackets, fur coats, can you believe it, in those days.
So was this a family business or were you just working for
somebody? No, I was just a day jobber, you know.
Right,
I turned,
cool, yeah, yeah.
And they paid me. And it was a really tough time back then because it was in the 80s. And so we had the miners' strike going on, for those of you that remember that.
And yeah, my dad was a miner, so yeah, I do remember it.
Yeah, so was mine, yeah. So it was a really tough time. And there wasn't, you know, as you can imagine, there wasn't a lot of money around and there wasn't
no.
any. So it was a pretty depressing time back then. And so working in the market, that was sort of what was on offer. And interesting, you know, I sort of just got on with it and enjoyed it, but it wasn't what I wanted from my life. So learned some great sales skills there, obviously. Mm. But the opportunity came up, I was about 18 at the time, and it was a really exciting opportunity because I could go to and live in Portugal and sell timeshare. So that's what I did. I went off to Portugal when I was 18, and I was one of those people that used to walk along the seafront, encouraging people to go in and see the timeshare resort. We were called OPCs. I don't know if you ever come across them.
No.
Basically, you got paid for everyone that you sent into the timeshare resort.
Right.
And I did that and slowly moved on to actually selling the timeshare for a few years until I was about 21. And throughout that period, I met my husband, and we had our son, Ash, who you know, and life just carried on for a few years until I reached, I reached a bit of a crisis point in my late 20s when my marriage ended. And that was a bit of one of those turning point moments when I realized that I was sort of 1995-ish wondering what had happened to my life. Because I don't know if anyone who's gone through a divorce, it feels like very often your life has imploded on you. You know, there's so much going on. You're looking out. You had a young child. I didn't have a job at the time. I didn't have any qualifications. Marriage was ending. Had to sell the house. You know, we weren't a wealthy couple at all. I at that point, I knew I needed some help from a solicitor because we had to go through the divorce. And we wanted to keep it an amicable divorce. But particularly back in those days, it felt like a war zone. I can remember coming out from the initial consultation, being told I had to you couldn't leave the property, whatever I did. I had to stay in the property, and it had to be a battle, and I really didn't want that. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I had what I perceived as pretty poor advice, and I started researching how to do it myself. And that's actually where I ended up leaving the marriage with the grand total of £7,000 and without a home. So that was pretty dire. And I can remember at that time feeling pretty desperate. What do I do with this £7,000? And it was at that point I decided, everyone thought I was mad, but I decided my experience going through my divorce had sparked an interest in the law. And which was quite amazing, because to be honest, if I thought back to my school days, the last thing I ever wanted to do was something as boring as being a lawyer. So I made this decision. I can remember telling my friends and family, right, I'm going to qualify as a lawyer. And just absolutely nobody had any belief in me whatsoever. And that was pretty disheartening, but I pushed along and I joined the local college Access to Law course back in 1996. And I just rented a property at the time just to get by. It was me and Ash. But I completed that year. And you know, it was throughout that year, the tutor on the Access to Law course said to me, you know, you can do this. If you want to qualify, you need to go to a university, you need to get a degree, that's the next stage, and you can do it, do it. And the thing was that she was the first person that had ever believed in me. And that was a really impactful thing, that someone believed that I could actually qualify as a solicitor. You know, here's me, no qualifications, had a bit of a car crash of a life up until my late 20s. And she said, go and do it. And so I applied for university and I got in. So I went off to Cardiff University, cut a long story short, and got my law degree, got my professional qualifications, and I qualified in 2014.
Wow.
So, and that was, to me, incredible. And it's I always knew I wanted to qualify because I wanted to help people going through divorce. And that's what I did. I qualified, I became a family law solicitor. And I loved doing the client work, but I wanted more. You know, I had this sort of desire, a burning desire to help as many people as possible. And to do that, I needed to create what I saw at the time as more me's. And that sort of manifested itself into me taking over the department, the family law department, where I, the solicitor's practice where I qualified. And then I went on to become a partner in that firm. And in 2007, I decided I wanted to create my own law firm. So I took over a firm called Parfitt Creswell in Fulham Broadway, which was a small practice that had been going on for about 100 years, you know, just a handful of staff, typical high street law firm. And it was from there that I started to develop the practice that we have today. And over the last 12 years, we've grown substantially. We were sort of, I think it was six people in one office, and now we're about 100 people across eight locations in London, southeast of England. So it all sort of stemmed, my whole business effectively stemmed from a crisis point in my life back in the mid 90s, getting divorced, having a bad experience, realizing that I wanted more from my life, and two, I didn't want other people to experience the same legal advice that I'd gone through, the same sort of experience in using legal services. So our business is created to sort of what we want to do is help people to deal with them, the issues that they have in their life, whether it's divorce, dealing with a death, moving house, all those sort of stressful things everyday people encounter. That's what we've created within our law firm. Our legal services address those issues. And that's what we want to carry on doing. And of course, things move on, and I've been involved in a number of other businesses since that. But that the law firm is my core business. That's been my journey, and the learning curves that we've gone through as we've grown have been huge. Because when I first took over the firm in 2007, I'd had some management experience as a partner in my previous firm, but to be honest, you know, it's like a baptism of fire, Don. When you walk in and you realize this was a much smaller business, I was the one who had to deal with everything from making sure we had somebody cleaning the office, which was sometimes me, to paying the VAT returns, to making sure the billing went out, to making sure the cash came in, to making sure we had new clients, we were serving existing clients. So there was this whole host of stuff going on. And on top of that, about 6 months after I took over the business, the recession hit. Do you remember back in 2008?
Yeah.
Now, the reason why I bought this firm was because it was a great firm and it had regular business. So I thought I was giving myself a really good start. But the one thing that I suppose I hadn't really considered, or I hadn't managed the risk, it was heavily property focused at the time. And it did a little bit of family, which I wanted to build, which I thought was great. It did some what we call private client, which is wills, probate, elderly client care, and so on. But it had a large property part. And when the recession hit, it just wiped out half of our property work. And that was really painful, because the property work is, in a law firm, is quite fast turnover work. You know, people buy a house and you want to get it completed, don't you, as soon as possible. So that means your bills get paid really quickly. And when you, that was our cash flow. So when we lost half of that property work, it really hit home that actually we were struggling without that. And I can always remember looking at the numbers and thinking, Lord, you know, it doesn't matter how many hours I work, I'm going to struggle to pay the bills at the end of each month. You know, I had a small amount of staff to pay. I had the rent, I had the rates. I had to take something out of it myself. And I had the loan that I'd taken out to buy this business. And it was at that point I realized I got to really get focused on business development. And I realized I really had to understand good financial management.
That is just to jump in there a second, because I'll come back to the market and the animates, and because I'm fascinated, I just want to pick up on a couple of points that you said. One is just the one that you just mentioned there. I think this is something that a lot of my guys go through, where they have this, that they work really hard to build it up, and then they have this kind of crippling realization that, just what you just said, like, shit, like, you know, I'm almost running out of time here to do anything else, and this is it. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is, and like, and it's not enough, you know, it's not enough for what, you know, you kind of create a business that, I'm not saying you created it, but you bought it, didn't you? And so you create a business that you know, not physically can't do the job for you, you know, it's not going to provide for you what you want, you know, and it's, some people never have that realization, you know, and they carry on forever, you know, with the head in the sand kind of thing.
They've created a job for themselves, or they go out of business because they're living on cash flow and not creating profit.
Yeah, for sure. And what you just said about the recession and the property stuff ties in so well with the ledger that I've just literally sent out today to my guys, because in the first story I talk about Murphy's Law, and like, if it can go wrong, it will go wrong. And you know, you've got to, I even said in the ledger, you know, I don't want to come across as like Dom the doomsayer here, but you have to be a bit paranoid, and you have to be a bit about your business, don't you? And I look at it objectively and say, am I too reliant on these couple of clients, or am I too reliant on this seasonal work? And yeah, just funny things that you've mentioned. I mean, loads of things about the breakup and stuff. And I have a lot of guys, not a lot of guys, but a lot of my guys have been through a similar thing. And you know they had to pick themselves back up again, like as you did as well. So there's tons of, and the other thing I was going to say as well was the sort of passion that you had, which you still got now to help people who were in a similar situation as what you were. You know, my guys have that obviously with the dogs. You know, so they've been in a situation where they've had a dog who they've loved, but they've hated at the same time because the behavior hasn't been very good. They've got bad advice from somebody, and it's kind of inspired them to go on and start their own dog businesses, you know. So there's tons of stuff that yeah. Anyway, sorry to jump in. So you're just about to talk about I guess you were just about to talk about how what you realized you needed to get your shit together and learn out about marketing and stuff and business proper, yeah.
Absolutely. I think the first thing, the panic set in, and I really wanted to know how the numbers worked in the business, because I was looking at them and it could have been different language, Don. I wasn't getting it, so I got a bit of help in for that. Fortunately, I've been working with a guy who had worked at, was helping my previous firm on a consultancy basis, so he helped me really understand the numbers there and getting to grips with them, and we still work together to this day. And that was just understanding how, if you've got financial, if you keep up to date with your financial information, you don't have the nasty surprises. If you know at the end of each month how much you've spent, how much has come in, what's the profit or loss, you can make those adjustments practically there and then to make sure that you're running at a profit. There's no point being the busy fool and offering this great service if ultimately there's no profit in there. You just can't live on that. And it can become really exciting when you realize, for the way it worked for me in our business was every desk I had in the office, I realized that I could bring in fee income of £180,000 a year from each seat. And once I realized that, my job was then to make sure that I could get enough work in to keep a person busy and get that £180,000 in. And then it was a question of how much that member of staff would cost me, what were the additional overheads, and what was the profit in there. It can be very simple. You can make it very complex, but it can be very simple when you're running a business. What service can you offer? How much is it going to cost you to offer that service, and what can you sell it for?
I think keeping it simple is a good advice. And Teresa, I remember back to the mastermind we were at once, and without going into details about it, but there was another lawyer there who had an idea to do something else with to go down a particular path. And if I remember rightly, you kind of, well, not advised, you know, but re recommended that he didn't do that because it was too risky. And you sort of, you recommend that sort of bread and butter stuff that you obviously is the mainstay of your business. It's there all the time, isn't it? I guess that's why you've stuck to that formula.
Absolutely. You've got to know what you offer, and you've got to be good at what you offer, and you've got to know who your ideal client is. And pull the two together, you've got a good business. Now you can offer high-end stuff, you can offer other opportunities, but you've got to have your core work that is going to cover your costs and make some money for you. And if you've got that, you've got a sound business. And particularly if you can create repeat work from it.
And I'll be honest, this is kind of what I've done with mine, I guess, with the dog adventure business. You know, it kind of ticks over. I could push it more, but it kind of ticks over. But that has provided the base for everything else, you know. And I've done some, my guys know I've done some things that haven't worked particularly well. I did an online store that was a disaster. I fucking hated it. I wasted thousands of pounds on it. But you know, other things have gone particularly well, like the books and the speaking and, you know, all this kind of thing. And so it's like that has provided, yeah, you're right. Having some kind of, you've got to have that, haven't you? You've really, and you've got to take time as well. I think it's not even so much bright shiny object, but people get like too many ideas. You've got to take time to really get this core business like locked down and as profitable as you can before you start,
You've
you
got
know.
to find Because, and you know, when you think wherever you focus, that's where your energy goes. And you mentioned you tried an online business and you hated it. Now, the chances of that being successful were always going to be pretty slim, I would have thought, because you hated it.
Yeah, and for sure. I didn't realize I'd hated it until I started. But there you go. No, you're right. Yeah, you did right.
Don't worry. I've had some mad things I've done and I've hated them. And I'm thinking, why am I doing that? It's not making any money and I hate it.
So what were the kind of, you talked there about getting like real like basic stuff really, but people don't do, and I definitely don't even do enough of this, like you say, like being on top of your numbers, getting you, was there any kind of game changing things that you did that enabled you to then kick on and go from where you went with Perfect Crystal to where you've taken it to?
Yeah, the big thing, I mentioned the financial management. So it was creating that business plan effectively, whatever you want to call it. It's sitting down and get a scrap of paper if you want. You know, keep it, if you're uncomfortable with financial management, don't think of it particularly numbers. Just think, what have I got? Now, for me, I'll give you an example. That was an office with, I think at the time, it was six desks. So I needed a couple for support staff and one for me because I had to sit somewhere. So I had three other seats that I could call what we term as fee earning seats. So people that are going to sit there and churn out fee earning, you know, income, provide legal services. And I just jotted down that allowing for how many hours in the day, how many could reasonably be expected to be actual legal work. I worked out that I could get £180,000 a year from each person, each of those three seats. And that took me up to just over £500,000 plus other bits and pieces. So if you're looking at, say, we reckon, just say it was 500,000, look at what your overheads are. You had your rent, your rates. You know whether you're going to be in profit or not. You also have to look at where the work's coming from. Fortunately, we had a client bank at that time, so we had to make the most of that. But we also realized we needed to get good at business development, marketing, because historically, although the firm had been around for a long time, it had never, ever, ever placed an advert other than Yellow Pages. Mm. It was like the basic one-liner. So it really was just on a basic level, looking at what I had available to me right there and then, what I could offer and how much it was going to cost. So that was just understanding, listing what expenses I had going out, what assets I had in terms of how could I make money, and making sure that I knew I had to get good at getting work in.
Whether it's you had to get good at marketing, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's particularly, you know, where I got into direct response marketing.
Yeah,
I can remember getting really excited. I went online probably about, this was probably taking me to, I started looking around end of 2008, 2009, and coming across the first version of direct response marketing and going to a conference in London and coming out of that so excited, realized I had so much more control in my business than I realized. I realized that how much money I could make, provided I could get the work in. And now I realize that there was methods of getting work in and how to position myself as a as a lawyer, how to position the business, how to create ads, the brand
ads. Get a lead flow going,
I mean, my direct response started by putting articles out. So there used to be, I don't know if it's still out there now, because I haven't done it for a while, but what was it called? Submit an article. It was Oh, goodness. The name will come back to me in a moment. But you
Okay.
literally put your article out there, and it would get up picked up by news
Right,
sites.
yeah.
So we got picked up in the Times, and we also got picked up in the Times India, so some of them could be quite random. But at that time, it acted as a good SEO
Yeah,
collector,
booster.
basically. And I got people back to the website. I got into pay-per-click advertising, and in the early days when it was much easier than it is now, when you could do it yourself
Yeah.
without driving yourself crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very much a matter of promoting ourselves. So that's really how we started to get into direct response marketing and speaking to ten.
Teresa, just hang on 2 seconds.
This conference will now be recorded.
Apologize for that little brief interruption there, Teresa. There was somebody at the door. Anyway, carry on.
Not at all. Basically, what I learned was that the main thing was what we needed to do was to have as many pillars of lead generation, new potential clients coming into our business as possible. So it could be getting articles out there, writing to local newspapers for them to ask them with a great news story that was relevant to get them to publish it, doing some online stuff on pay-per-click. We started advertising in local newspapers. So it all started to create an awareness of this business that had been sitting on Fulham Broadway for such a long time, but hadn't been getting this message out there. And it just made me realize how powerful it is when you can communicate well to that outside world. You can get to a position where you can turn leads on or off, turn new client tap on or off as you need to. And although in the beginning it was hit and miss, I realized I just needed to get better and better at this because that was the way forward. If I could do that, I could build any business that I wanted to. So I just kept in, and I had we were doing okay. We started to we were getting the business back into profit, and it was running well. We were getting a much higher profile in the area. So we wanted more growth. We wanted to expand, and we had a couple of opportunities that came up. And it was just one of those things that came from nowhere, really. I got a phone call one day, and it was somebody who I put a job advert in for a commercial property solicitor, and it was for our Fulham office because that was the only office at the time. And this woman gets on the phone, and she says to me, "I'm way too qualified for the job you've got on offer, but I just wanted to ask you. I'm in a firm in Windsor, and unfortunately, the firm's going to close quite soon." And she went into the reasons why. And she said, "But I've been here a while, and I've got quite a few clients, and I need to find a new home. Would you be interested in talking about it?" So I said, "Oh, absolutely, yes. Come, I'm there. Just give me a chance to drive over." So we got together, and it became quite clear that her clients were Windsor based. And we were Fulham based, so it seemed the sensible thing to do was to open an office in Windsor, which we did. The tricky situation was she was talking to me at it was something like the 18th, 19th of December, and the firm was closing a few days later. And of course, we had the Christmas break, and how on earth do we get an office open? But we managed it, and we opened on the 4th of January. A couple of weeks later, and that's where our office in Fulham, in Windsor began. And we spoke to the firm that was closing, and a number of their staff joined us. I think it was four altogether, and a number of the clients came over. So that was that opportunity that just presented itself that we took, and that was our second office.
And
So
so was that the start of the expansion then?
that's
Obviously started it, but was it had you thought about it much before that or not really?
No, I hadn't, which is
No.
quite scary, really, isn't it? You hadn't it that wasn't on the agenda. But when we took a view that again, it was a risk management view. We knew we had a certain amount of work that was coming in, and we knew that we could take a short-term lease, in serviced offices. So we again looked at the numbers and decided that even if it was a failure, we could manage it because of the financial the income that was coming in compared to what the income going out would be.
Yeah,
and that turned into that's one of our flagship offices now. It's grown over the years since 2011, January 2011, and it's an interesting one because when you're in business, opportunities present themselves, and very often you have to say no because you can't do it or you shouldn't do it. But so often, I think sometimes we say no because we think it's impossible. You know, it's impossible to open up a new law firm in 2 weeks. Well, it's not, because we've done it.
It's focus.
And so many things in business come down to what you focus on. So
yeah. I guess in a way, Teresa, there's probably an element of, like, done is better. There must have to be an element of done is better than perfect about that, isn't it? Because you can't, obviously you aren't going to have an office like what you already had at Fulham Broadway, but it's like, it'll do, won't it? You know, like, when and then we'll just make it better from there.
And Don, if you see, I can see us now, the 4th of January 2011, we're cramped. There's four of us cramped into this room in which is like the size of a shoebox, by the way. And you know what some lawyers are like, you know, they do like their own office, and all I could offer was, they were lucky if they weren't sharing a desk, let alone sharing a room.
Yeah.
So, but the bottom line is, it was an opportunity, and they could see that, you know, had they not taken that, they may have gone further afield, or they may not have had jobs, their clients wouldn't have been looked after. And that gave us a great opportunity to get into that local area in Windsor, to meet the clients and to start building from there.
Yeah.
And of course, that opens up another area for us to share the love and share the knowledge and share what we do. But we hit a bit of a problem, because although I've created this lovely, warm, fuzzy feeling in Fulham with all my articles and pay-per-click and newspaper bits and pieces, nobody knew us in Windsor. We had no credibility whatsoever. Even though we'd been around a long time in Fulham, we were a brand new firm in Windsor. So we desperately needed to communicate with that local community. And we found the best way for us was actually in the local newspapers at the time. And it was from there that we started advertising heavily in the local newspapers, just to create this awareness of us. And it was okay, but it wasn't really where we wanted to be. And it was really fortunate. One of the guys that I know we've both used as a mentor, showed me how to write the perfect direct response ad for a newspaper. You know, we're using the ADA principle, headline, getting the right first paragraph. And I worked with him and we tweaked this. And that ad went on to bring in millions of pounds worth of fees.
Really? Wow.
I mean, it was incredible. We were doing okay. It was the same ad, you know, basically the same content in the ad, but by just tweaking it, it just exploded. I can remember the family solicitor saying to me, "What on earth have you done? Where's all this work coming from?" And it was from this advert. So I think focus and getting it right. If you can find your right, the right medium that speaks to your client, it's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, and work to get, you know, good or better at writing copy and stuff as well. It's all good skills to have, aren't they? You know, essential skills even.
Yeah, but the thing is, once you get it right, once you realise what works with your clients, you can adjust, and you know, you can turn it into different offers. You can even move it into a different environment. That, for example, we used a different ad, but the same principles for wills, for probate, and they all worked really well. So that was one of one of the big key moments, I think, in advertising, in marketing, that I learned the importance of being able to put together a great ad that is true to who you are. You know, that you're, you're speaking to your, you're speaking directly to your potential clients, and they believe that you're speaking to them, and it's not just some flash ad.
Yeah. No, no, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. Authentic, I guess. Since then, how many offices have we got now?
Oh gosh, I think we've moved on so much. We went from Windsor to Kent. We took over three more law firms in Kent. Then we moved into Sussex, and we opened up another one in central London. And then we opened up in Reading. So I think it's eight altogether now. I lose count.
Wow. Yeah. And are you keen to do more, or is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's more on the way. Yeah. Hopefully we'll do another one this year. It's very much a case of, it's been an interesting process, because, you know, as you grow a business, you hit a particular level, and it's almost like glass ceilings as you grow a business. And it's one, you can get there, you can get caught on turnover. I know sort of that 700,000 to a million can be a struggle to get over a million in turnover. Mm-hmm. And then I can remember it again at about 2.5 million, needed that extra push. Mm-hmm. But it's not just turnover, it's the platform that you work off as a business. You also need to, as the business grows, that obviously needs to grow as well. And sometimes the people, well, every time, as you grow in a business, the people need to grow as well. And that was the sort of, when we moved on from the first key point being understanding your numbers, financial management, the next key point for me was business development, was marketing, you know, getting the work in, client acquisition. Then my next key learning curve, I think, certainly was understanding the people that were working with me. And very often you'll have somebody in your business who is absolutely brilliant. But as the business grows, they're reluctant or unable to grow with it. So they're ability in the business isn't as strong as it once was, and learning to manage that has been the third phase in running a successful business, a growing business, because change can be tough. If you're not the sort of person that can embrace change, it can be a really draining, an energy sapping event. So learning how to manage change and bring people with us has been a really important learning curve, and it wasn't something that I sort of anticipated, really. I assumed everyone was excited about the growth and what we were doing, and were on board for it. And I think it's not a case that they're not on board for it, that they just, it's not, you know, if they've joined a firm and it's got 10 people in it, sometimes they're there because they want to work in a firm with 10 people in it.
Yeah.
And not a firm that has multi offices, and so the systems and processes have to change to accommodate a multi office business. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly the coaching element of working with staff and mentoring staff has become much more relevant in our business than it once was. And we ended up creating what we call the Business Academy, where we meet every 2 months and have a day together, and we go through what's going on, and we give new updates on the business. But it's not really a technical, it's not about the technical side of things. It's about us as people, how we grow and how we develop, and understanding each other's personalities and how we communicate with our clients. So it's all the soft skills that go on in the business that actually have as much of an impact to success and profitability as the technical side, you know, the legal side we offer.
No, 100%. I think we should, if it's all right with you, I think we should do another one of these. Because we'll do another one of these because I think there's a lot. I mean, this wasn't going to be the focus of this, but I think there's a lot. It's been great, fantastic to hear your story and learn so much. But I think there's a lot. Obviously, I contacted you because of the franchising article and to sort of go into that. And I think that we'll go on to that now to finish us off. But I think we'll come back again if that's all right with you, because I would be interested to do more of an in-depth chat about that side of it, about how you grew and how you learned to be a manager and the mistakes that you made. And you know what I mean, Therese? I think that would be really beneficial for me and for everybody, for all of my guys as well, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, there's loads of them. So, but yeah, moving on to the franchise.
Yeah, so go on.
Really interesting, isn't it?
Tell us how, because you literally, is it something, have you had a franchise before? Is it something that you just, what are your reasons for being interested in it?
No, I was talking to somebody who's an accountant, and they grow a great business, and it's a franchise business. And it's the first time that it really made me think about the benefits of franchising from, you know, both sides. If you're looking at buying a franchise, because I said to him, why did you buy a franchise? You know, you're perfectly capable of running your own accountancy practice. What attracted you? And he explained that what he wanted to do, he wanted to move out of employment. He wanted to do his own thing, but he wanted to make sure that he had a proven business model. Mm-hmm. So that would give him the confidence to take that step out of employment. And he felt sure it enhanced his chance of success in business. And if you look at the stats, it does. A franchise business is far more likely to be successful than somebody just setting up on their own. And that's basically because the model's been tried and tested. The franchise, or if it's a good one, will be offering you training and support because it's in their interest for their franchisee to succeed. Mm. You know, they'll talk about marketing. They'll have what they call back-end products that, yeah, you pay for them, but they do help you get more clients, work more effectively and efficiently. And it's a support network.
Yeah. So
there's lots of good reasons to buy into a franchise.
Yeah, I think I would be of a similar mind to what you were at the start of that piece where you said, why did you do that? You know, because I would be thinking someone, same thing. Well, why would you do that when you could have your own thing with your own app? But like, not everybody's you, are they as well? I think that's a different, you know, not everybody's got, and you summed it up very well with the guy, his needs for security and, you know, help, and that were the primary sort of factors, weren't they, behind him? I'm gonna leave my job, but I'm gonna do it under, I will only do it under these circumstances, you know. Whereas I kind of, when I started my business, and you had slightly different reasons when you started yours, but it's like, I'm like, fuck it, I'm gonna do this. And
yeah,
I don't know, but some people, it just, we're all different, aren't they? Not everyone's you. So there's people out there who are desperate to become dog walkers, trainers or groomers, but they're the same as they are lawyers and accountants, but they just they need more help.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you think about it, I suppose if you just want to jump in, you want to have a business that's practically made for you. Yeah, you just got to go in, do the work, or offer the service, whatever it is. It's not a bad thing, is it?
It's
got a lot of real plus points. And if you're, you know, you make sure you're aware of what can go wrong. You need to make sure it's good quality franchisor, and you really understand the contract and what you're getting yourself into and whether it's scalable. You know, if you want to be looking for a scalable business, maybe you need to make sure that that's possible. But, you know, there's lots of good sides to it. But I think coming back to your question, why did I start looking at it? When I spoke to this accountant guy, why he got into it, at the same time, I was looking at how can I scale my business beyond what I've got at the moment. Now, I'm really grateful and I celebrate for what I've got. But, you know, my overall sort of long-term ambitions is I want this to be a national brand. I want to be able to say I can touch people in Sunderland, Newcastle, Wales, wherever. And I want to attract people who buy into what I stand for. So, and I've been doing that by recruiting people in the normal sort of employee sense. We opened up the Reading office by, you know, promoting somebody into I'm thinking of it, it's not office management, but she was running that branch. She was director of that branch. And that's great. And that, at the same time, I was thinking, well, how can we really fast track this? So I started thinking about franchising and how it would work. And it's still on the back burner. You know, I still think about it because it is a really quick way of growing your business if you get it right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, when you think about if I open up an office or Dom, you were to open up another opportunity, you'd have to find the right staff because you can't have two of you. You know, you can only be in one location. You have to go through all the overheads. You have to make sure it's being run properly. Whereas you think about franchising, you've got someone who's going to pay you for your systems, services, and everything else you offer in your business today. Mm-hmm. So they've got skin in the game.
Yeah.
And they're unlikely to leave like a recruited person who could just go for another couple of grand at another pet business or another law firm. So it's quite attractive.
Yeah, they're more that whole, I mean, you know, and I know a lot of people on the call might not be getting as much from this, but that whole bought in factor is massive, isn't it? And actually, from experience, speaking to a couple of people who have been in franchises, dog ones or that I've known, they're very passionate about their franchise. Even though to me, like often I'm like, I mean, I haven't said this to them, but I'm like thinking, well, I can't understand why you've done that. To me, it's holding you back. Do you know? But I'm not, like I said, I've got different motivations there. But they're incredibly bought into it. That connection element, isn't it?
Yeah. But the thing is about franchising, it can be a win-win each side.
Yeah.
Franchisor, that's the person setting it up, and the franchisee, the person buying into it. The key to it is actually knowing what you're buying, or being very clear on what you're selling if you're the franchisor. Mm-hmm. And being able to document it and train the franchisee as they have the success, and from the franchisee being willing to, obviously, if they're willing to put their money in, the chances are they're willing to go through the training and get good at everything that's on offer.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. And so have you, I'm a bit unsure, I'm a bit unclear. Are you, when you've been sniffing around, have you been thinking about starting a franchise or looking at buying into a franchise?
No, starting.
Starting one. Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, I was just checking.
Sorry. Yeah, my interest was piqued by the accountant who had bought into one, but I was thinking of it from the other side. How could I grow my business further by being
the franchise? Roll it out. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Pigeon up what I offer, all the systems, all the processes, you know, how to, everything from how to run a divorce file, for example, if we put it down to the basics, to how to get the clients in. So the whole customer journey.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Which people just don't know. They just don't know that. Even if they are good lawyers, good accountants, good dog trainers, good groom, you know, if they're good at that, they still don't know anything. Usually they don't know anything or very much at all about the actual business side of it, do they, you know?
Yeah, no. And I think that one of the, I suppose on the business side, whether you're a franchisor or a franchisee, there's a process to understand that there's an upfront fee to buy a franchise. Usually there would always be an upfront fee. It varies enormously. No, I was looking at one the other day, and it was a really small amount, £2,500 to buy all their ops, their systems, their processes, their operations manual. And that quite unusually didn't have any follow-up fee, any annual fee. But what in the vast majority of franchises, you have an upfront fee and you have the annual fee, the back end fee. And the annual fee, it can be things like supplies, extra services that are offered, extra training. So most franchise will have those extra annual fees that come out, and it's important to understand that because that can have an impact on profitability on both sides. So if you're the franchisee buying into it, you need to know that you're going to be spending, say, an extra 20 grand a year. This is just an example. And from the franchisor, you need to know that that's coming into your business because that's your annual income too. And the other main part is to think about on both sides, how many locations, how many times are you going to sell this franchise? So if you look at, let's just take a pet business, Don, you packaged everything up you had to offer. You had great client journey and back end offerings that were completely documented, easy to follow. So you're going to get your upfront fee for that. You'd also consider your annual fee, things that are ongoing processes that you would be offering. Now, how many times would you sell that franchise? How many locations across the country? And it's okay, you can think I'll sell it as many as possible, but you've also got to think the franchisee has to be able to make a good income from that business. So it's not in your interest to saturate the market. It's in your interest to make sure that you get the number right so that you know your franchisees are going to be making money.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, no, I totally do, yeah. I it's like I guess it's like I was just thinking as you were talking there, the way that I've built mine where I am it's premium and it's different and I have less clients than everybody else, but I don't need as many because we make it, you know what I mean? The LTV is a lot higher, et cetera. And well, obviously that's what I would be selling to somebody else, wouldn't I? I would be selling them the same blueprint. And that doesn't work if I'm selling two or three franchises in every city or something, does it? You know,
Definitely.
they have to be able to say they're the standout one as well, I guess.
Yeah. So you can sell by geographical location or you can sell by postcode, but you have to be clear what you're selling and they have to be clear what they're buying. And then once you get that clear, you can sort of work out if you're the franchisor what your income strategy is going to be. So say, Dom, sorry, I keep picking on you just
No,
for
do it. Yeah, I've got something interesting to say actually in a second. Well, you go on, carry on, carry on.
okay, I was just going to say you've decided across the country you'd have 20 locations. Your upfront fee was going to be 20,000. That's just to buy into your franchise. So as a business, you'd be looking at an what's that, 800,000 for just selling the franchise. Then say you had an annual fee of whatever services and products and bits and pieces you were offering as a back end annual fee, that would be a £20,000 per annum charge that you were getting from each of those 20 franchisees. That would give you an income of 400,000 per year as the franchisee, sorry, as the franchisor, the person selling. Now, what you need to be able to calculate for your franchisees is what they can expect in terms of income from their purchase of the franchise. And you would do that by showing the typical income that you've gained from your proven methods. So if you were making 50,000, 100,000, whatever it is, you need to be able to show that your method is a proven method of bringing in clients. Provided they follow your process and do the work well, that they're going to have every possibility and opportunity to achieve these results.
Yeah, no, I like it. Yeah, I think I was. I've never. I've always. My experience. I have no experience of them really. But this is something that quite a few people have said to me over the years. You should do that. You should. Have you thought about that? And I think it's because I've even before I learned about went on the direct response education. I've always invested a lot in the branding and stuff, you know. And I thought about the names and all. And you know, so the business has stood out for those reasons as being different. And but kind of shied away from it. And I think my business really at the minute is going more towards having less contact with people apart from my coaching clients. It's having like less, you know, and this is why I'm doing the books and stuff, you know, because I'm just on a slightly different journey at the moment. But saying that, after I finish the Impact event, I think the next thing that I'm going to do is like a dog walker's business in a box, you know. So basically taking all of the stuff that I've done, that I've taught my guys over the last 18 months, and package up and into some sort of program, you know. So it's like a dog walker's business box, and then I could do the same thing with a dog trainer's business box as well, and obviously I could sell that for whatever, and that would obviously be a good
thing to get people in.
But then I was thinking above that could be like a franchise element, possibly, couldn't it, where it's like, look, this is how you do it all on your own with some of my help, and this is how you do it exactly as after. I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, what you're
tossing talking ideas about around.
First one, packaging it all up, business in a box style, license it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically you can license it to an individual user, and they can use your if you put in templates or whatever it is. But if they wanted to have the additional help and resources and ongoing support, you can franchise it.
So it's like two options almost, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
How does licensing work then? Because I'm not really familiar with that at all.
Well, licensing is more, if you think about, you can license somebody to use your, it could be an image. Yeah, they can use that image, fine. But what they can't do is sell it on to somebody else.
Right, I see.
Think Microsoft license.
Yeah.
You know, you buy a license, you're entitled to use it, that's fine.
Yeah.
But you can't give it to somebody else.
No.
So that's licensing in its most basic form. And then the difference with franchising is you're giving more effectively, because very often you're very much giving that back end annual service or product or whatever it is that you're offering that helps them run their business and is key to their success as well.
Yeah. And this is like, this all kind of ties in, even the franchising thing. It's like just a logical next step, because what I'm getting a lot of my guys to do is what I've done in my business, which is get your systems, get everything systemized, you know, first, get your dog walk systemized, get all this, so that when you are full and you take some staff on or whatever, then it's like, we've got a process then, haven't we, you know? And this all just ties in, doesn't it, with...
Yeah.
Even if you're not interested in franchising, I was going to say that the book, the E-Myth, Michael Gerber book, he talks about, you know, treating it like a franchise, even though it isn't a franchise, you know.
Completely right. If you look at any successful business, they've all got really good systems and processes that everyone understands. Because it's all very well having these systems and processes in place, but if you don't have the training to go with it, they're just going to sit there and everyone's, you know, if somebody doesn't know what to do, they will find something, some way of doing something. They'll either not do it at all, or they'll find a way of doing it that the chances are won't be the right thing. So if you have systems and processes and really good training in place, that's helps create a successful business. And if you document it as you go along, then you've got a ready-made franchise model, or the beginnings of a ready-made franchise model.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got assets, haven't you? Yeah, that you can use however you want. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah. Certainly, anyone sort of starting their business journey, document everything you do, and you know, if it's success, you can reflect on it and see what works. If you come across an area that doesn't work very well, you can then look at it clearly in black and white and say, well, what's going on there? What do I need to tweak to make it work?
Yeah. Right, Teresa, we're going to have to wrap this up because I'm going to run out of tape. Tape? CD. but that has been absolutely wonderful. I've thoroughly enjoyed, from a personal level, I've thoroughly enjoyed, because we're working together a bit closely anyway more, aren't we, now with the connections B2B thing and stuff. And
we're delighted.
Oh, no, I'm chuffed to be there. It's fab. And it's good for me too, really good for me. So, yeah, so thanks for that. It's been awesome. When I officially close the call, I'll keep talking to you, and we'll get another date in the diary, hopefully, and come back, because I feel like we're on a bit of a roll here. And we can go and maybe talk a bit more about franchising, the pros and cons of it, and we can talk a bit about how you sort of the management skills that you kind of had to teach yourself along the way?
Yeah, absolutely. Have to.
Wonderful, wonderful. So, Teresa, where can people go to find out a bit more about you? And is there a place or not? Is it the Donkey Sanctuary? Where do we? tell people about the donkeys. Come on.
Do you know, I've got three beautiful rescue donkeys from the Donkey Sanctuary, and they're darling, darling boys. They're the eldest one's called Glenn, middle one's Lincoln, and the baby is Horace. So what are they now? They must be 10, 8 and 6 years old.
You must get this in as well, because this will, not that you need endearing, but this will endear you to my crowd even more. Tell us your dogs' names, please.
Oh, I've got two dogs. I've got Peggy, who's a black Labrador cross. And I've got Scotty, who's...
No, wait, she's not just called Peggy and Scotty. What are their full titles? How are you? Come on. Ash has already told me, so you're not divulging any secrets here.
Oh, do you know, they have so many titles that they're Prince Peggy. Prince Scotty. They're my precious little pumpkins.
Brilliant. superb. Thank you, Teresa. It's been wonderful, and I look forward to speaking to you again very, very soon.
Wonderful. Thanks, Dom.